The sanctions against Iran appear to be working.
And that comes with a cost.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, March 15th, the Ides of March.
Coming up, HBO cancels a new show after three horses die in production.
What's going on with the warm weather? Well, it depends on your perspective.
And the most incredible thank you note ever.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
U.S. sanctions against Iran appear to be doing what the Obama administration had hoped, weakening Iran's economy. The International Energy Agency says Iranian oil exports are now at a 10-year low. Problem is that might not be so great for the global economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The IEA says that Iran's oil production has fallen by 50,000 barrels a day as U.S. sanctions begin to bite. But that's nothing, the agency says. By the time the European Union's embargo also comes into effect this summer, Iranian output could fall much further, perhaps by as much as 1 million barrels a day. This will pile unprecedented pressure on Iran. Oil accounts for 80% of its exports and provides one half of its government revenues. But, says Nick McGregor, an oil analyst with brokers Redmayne Bentley, the dwindling Iranian output is raising fears about global oil supplies.
If anything major were to happen to disrupt another significant supplier, then there is the question at the moment as to whether or not there would be adequate supply to meet what is, even in these tough economic times, record demand.
Oil prices have already risen by 20% since last December. Some economists fear further price hikes could derail the U.S. recovery. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The government said the number of people applying for unemployment benefits dropped last week by 14,000 to 351,000. That is a four-year low. Meanwhile, prices at the wholesale level jumped by 0.4% in February. That's the biggest jump in 5 months, thanks to an increase in energy costs.
Now, keep that in mind as we get into our next story, which is getting a lot of attention this morning. A respected analyst at J.P. Morgan in Hong Kong says China's economy is already experiencing a, quote, hard landing. According to Bloomberg, the analyst says car sales are down, cement production is down, steel production is down, construction stocks are down. It's not a debate anymore about a hard landing. It's a fact. Adolfo Laurenti is deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and he joins us now from Chicago to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Adolfo, do you agree that China's slowdown is really happening, that it's in full swing?
There is no question China is slowing down right now. I think it's in the eyes of the beholder to define a hard landing. According to that report, it's a 6% growth, which I would say for our standard would be very positive. But clearly, it's not the China growing the way it was until a couple of years ago. So something is happening in China, and we should pay very close attention.
And if that is happening, Adolfo, is that the kind of thing that could lower demand, bring down prices of things like gas here in this country? Could it actually help our economy?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. We always think about China as a source of export to the United States, but in reality, we also sell a lot of goods and services to China. So in that respect, the hard landing would not be a good news. Yes, the price, energy prices would come down, commodity prices would come down, but we also have to keep in mind that unlike energy, commodities are just a small portion of the overall cost of our product. So the overall impact is not going to be as big as we may expect.
Adolfo Laurenti, Deputy Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yesterday, we told you the national average for a gallon of regular unleaded gas was $3.81. Well, guess what? Now it's $3.82.
And as you may have heard yesterday, we spoke with a mechanic here in L.A. named Rebecca Flyshaker, who gave us some fuel efficiency tips. One of them was that using premium gas might get you better gas mileage in the long run. Well, many of you wrote to tell us you disagreed with that advice, so we sent Marketplace's Sarah Gardner out to do a little fact-checking.
took me less than 2 minutes to find somebody filling up with premium. The first driver said her little BMW required it, so she had to pay the $4.56 per gallon price tag. Same story from Dale Ingram, who pulled in minutes later in his 2002 Porsche.
So yeah, we're at $69 for 15 gallons of gas. It's getting kind of crazy. I'm still kind of going, oh boy, am I really doing this?
But Consumer Reports' Jeff Bartlett says if your owner's manual doesn't say your car requires premium, even if it recommends premium, don't waste the 20 cents per gallon extra.
Premium gasoline has some theoretical benefits, but in the real world and in Consumer Reports testing, we haven't seen that played out.
Benefits like more horsepower, less wear on your engine, or better mileage.
After all, manufacturers are spending millions of dollars to eke out just one or two more miles per gallon for their vehicles. If all they had to do is tell you to choose a different nozzle at the gas station, they would.
But a lot of drivers in everyday cars still believe in the power of premium. The driver of a beat-up 94 Chrysler minivan insisted to me her van shifts gears more easily because of it. But at today's prices, she's sticking with regular. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Call it a Jones for Facebook stock. It's not yet traded publicly, but it's become something of a black market bonanza. Joining us is Marketplace's Gregory Warner to talk about this. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
So what's happening with this?
So you picture a guy in a trench coat walking up to you in a park and saying, hey, want to buy some Facebook stock? That's pretty much what the pre-IPO market looks like. Now, of course, you or I can't buy this stock, David, but I called Bill Singer. He's a former regulator, now private lawyer. He says he regularly fields calls from clients getting cold calls from shadowy firms promising shares of Facebook. But, oh yeah, there are these hidden commissions and the money has to be wired through Nigeria.
It has become quite seedy, and some of the folks that have been soliciting and getting involved in this area are very reminiscent of the worst ilk that we once saw in the penny stock sector.
So yesterday, the SEC brought charges against two money managers who allegedly misled and overcharged investors, and maybe that's a sign that the sheriffs have arrived to the Wild West.
But, you know, Wild West has always been part of the stock market, for better or for worse. Why now SEC?
Well, first off, the market for private stock is getting bigger. Once it was limited to really wealthy investors and early employees. Now the bar is a little bit lower. There are these private exchanges, so the slightly less wealthy can get involved. Add to that the fervor Facebook, and you have a lot of people potentially getting ripped off. More cynical explanation is the SEC is trying to make up for missing Madoff.
All right, Gregory. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
The website is called Pinterest, as in to pin up something of interest, the fast-growing social network that lets you set up digital scrapbooks from stuff you find online. But do Pinterest users have the rights to those scraps? Here's Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
Kristen Kowalski is a photographer and a lawyer. She took down some of her own Pinterest posts because she worried she could be sued for copyright infringement.
The very first rule is don't pin anything that you don't own. And I thought, well, God, everyone out there is using this item properly. Everyone.
Kowalski has gotten lots of attention from a blog post where she compared Pinterest to the infamous music file sharing service, Napster.
Napster, you know, they put out a site where use of the site turned out to be something that was not legal.
This is the ultimate mountain out of a molehill situation.
Jack Lerner is an intellectual property professor at USC. He says many Pinterest posts tend to be low-resolution photos that link back to the original works.
And so by using a shrunken version, the courts have said that's likely to be fair use.
Lerner says Pinterest is much more like another site people use to share content, YouTube. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
HBO is canceling its new horse racing show, Luck, starring Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte. It's not being canceled because of ratings. It's being canceled because three horses have died in production of the show.
For more on this, we're joined by Ray Pollack. He publishes The Pollack Report, which covers the thoroughbred industry, and he's with us from Hot Springs, Arkansas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how surprising is it to you, someone who follows horse racing, that three horses died in the production of this program?
Well, I'm a little surprised that there were three deaths in this program because they, you know, they've used the association that helps television production companies oversee animals being used for films and TV.
Well, they've said, actually, HBO has come back and said, we maintain the highest safety standards throughout production, higher, in fact, than any protocols existing in horse racing anywhere, with many fewer incidents than occur in racing. Is that true?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, one of the problems with horse racing is there are no national mandated standards used. There are protocols that are used at some tracks, but not every track across the country because we're a state-regulated industry as opposed to a nationally regulated industry.
Well, how often do horses die in the course of horse racing? You follow this industry.
Well, it varies from state to state and from track to track, but it can run as low as one per thousand starts. So some tracks go months without a death, and some tracks have deaths more often than that.
Finally, let me just ask you how the horse racing industry feels about this show, Luck. Has it been good? Has it been bad for the industry?
I think most people regard it as a positive because it did shine the light on thoroughbred industry, on the good and the bad and sometimes the ugly side of it.
Ray Pollack is publisher of the Pollack Report, which covers the thoroughbred industry. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Some reaction now in financial media to the big story on Wall Street this week. Greg Smith, the Goldman Sachs guy who spectacularly quit his job with a poison pen column in the New York Times. Smith believes Goldman's culture has gone bad, exploits customers, and calls them Muppets. Today, Wall Street Journal columnist David Widner called Smith self-righteous, writing, quote, "When all is said and done, in the global economy, customers have always been and always will be Muppets." Bloomberg News has an editorial saying it's sorry the guy thought Goldman existed to bring peace and happiness to the world. Headline, "Yes, Mr. Smith, Goldman Sachs is all about making money."
And the Smith story is where we'll go next for our Midday Extra. And here to talk with us is Dr. Gary Sperduto, CEO of Sperduto & Associates, a corporate psychology consulting firm. Good morning.
Hey.
Well, what would make someone do something like this when they resign? Just go out with a bang like this and really not look back?
Well, a psychologist looking at this goes to anger first. And so the question becomes, what could be the sources of anger that would cause somebody to behave in this way?
How often does it happen?
Not that often. Somebody has to be pretty upset to come out as publicly as this. It happens more often than we know because a few of these become public, but it's an infrequent occurrence.
Because it comes, doesn't it, at a great social cost. Your network of friends and associates around you often abandon you after you do something like this.
Well, one certainly needs to think ahead, and it causes one to think that perhaps if one thinks ahead and still goes ahead with writing an article that's published like this, it really speaks to the injury the person feels that they're willing to take that route.
When you hear that somebody does something like this, is it always a bad thing in your mind, or sometimes do you go, yeah, you know what? They're doing the right thing.
I don't think framing it good or bad or wrong or right is a way to think about it. I think that what we should think is, what's the motivation? And just a few motivations. I think mostly it's retribution. This is somebody trying to get back at someone for a few things that are possible. And the retribution could be for perceived mistreatment. The retribution could be for a values misfit, where somebody just is so upset that they don't want to be identified with a culture, in this case, that he might perceive as avaricious or disrespectful of others. And so he's willing to go to this extent to sort of distance himself from that kind of culture. And another thing that can sometimes cause this is someone feeling as if they're not heard. If I was going to Goldman Sachs this morning to consult, I'd be talking to them about they need to identify and emphasize their standards for how they treat their customers, and also really emphasizing making sure they have opportunities for their people to be heard if they don't think customers are treated correctly. So I think we'd probably look somewhere in those sets of reasons for the kinds of motivation for this behavior.
Now, you mentioned this notion of a values misfit, in which a person may not feel that his values fit well with the work environment. I mean, that's another way of saying a person is taking what they see as a principled stand.
That's correct.
So that is one of the options.
That is totally an option, and I would think that if you were able to interview this individual, that's exactly how you would come away feeling. And that's how he thinks about himself and what he's doing here. I don't think these are attention-seeking moments for people because, as you implied earlier, there's just too much cost. This is motivated out of just becoming so upset that you're willing to put up with that cost.
Dr. Gary Sperduto is CEO of Sperduto & Associates, a corporate psychology consulting firm. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's March Madness time, which means productivity is about to plummet for those who love watching college basketball, and gambling is about to skyrocket because of those NCAA brackets that people are filling out and betting money on. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus is here to talk with us about gambling. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what are the numbers, David? How many of us gamble, whether that be lottery or casinos or whatever?
The answer is most of us. About 86% of Americans gamble at least once a year. That's talking going to casinos, March Madness, playing the ponies. About 16% of us gamble once a week.
And does that number change when the economy gets better or when it gets worse?
We see the number of gamblers go up as the economy goes down. And there's a reason for that. I mean, on the one hand, people are kind of looking for the brass ring to come their way. On the other hand, it's a matter of proximity and availability. In other words, more and more municipalities, states, counties are making gambling available because they're looking to gambling revenue to try to fill their coffers.
Because often schools or whatever get some money when people gamble.
Precisely.
Now, David, does the house always win? In other words, are the 86% of us who do gamble occasionally being stupid about it?
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it. The latest numbers available suggest that we lose, and that's the operative word here, we lose about $100 billion a year when we go gambling. Well, somebody has to take it in, and typically it's going to be the house. The house edge on most games is going to mean that they will win the longer you play. Now, if you play a game like blackjack, the house edge is smaller, and so it's going to take you longer to lose your money. You play a game like Keno, and you might as well just walk up, hand them your money, and walk away because you got no chance.
What about the enjoyment we get out of doing something like March Madness? Is there an upside to it at all?
I'd say the upside is the entertainment value. You have skin in the game. You're feeling good. You're a player. But more than likely, if you're gambling, you will lose. And especially with me, when it comes to March Madness, I just can't ever get it.
So just don't put too much on the line.
Not this time.
Have you filled out your bracket yet?
I'm still working on it.
All right. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Your politics even determines your take on the weather outside. That's one subject of our weekly Attitude Check.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. He joins us every Thursday. Good morning, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
So, listen, I got to ask you, Frank. It's been less than a week since the government said the jobs picture is getting better. But are we feeling better about the economy? And how's that playing out for another fellow whose job is tied to the economy? His name is Barack Obama.
Well, we sure did see signs, we think, in the data, very positive vibes that came from that report last Friday. In fact, over the weekend, our consumer confidence, as we track it here at Gallup, economic confidence, got as low as we have seen it since we have been tracking consumer confidence, which began in January of 2008. And the weekly average for last week, lots of interviews, tied the low that we had seen since 08. So clearly we saw an impact of this. And you ask about President Obama, same thing. His job approval rating improved in our data over the weekend and actually is staying fairly high now, we think at least in part as a result of the positive report last Friday.
Now, as so many conversations do, Frank, let's talk about the weather. I'm in New York and wore shorts after work yesterday. What do Americans make of this? Not my shorts, but the weather.
We did not ask about your shorts, but we'll do that next time. 79% of Americans, Dave, in answer to your question, said that, in fact, where they lived, it was warmer than usual this winter. The really fascinating thing came in when we followed up and said, all right, why? Is it global warming, or is this just normal variation that we get from year to year in the weather? And the fascinating thing about that is the results were not based on education, not based on your knowledge of global warming. It was
not based on looking out your window.
No, no, nothing like that. It was based on politics. If you're a Republican, 70% said, oh, this is just normal fluctuation. Independents tilted towards saying it was global warming. But Democrats across the country, a majority said, oh, no, this was global warming that caused the warmer than usual winter this year.
Politics, belief systems affecting our view of the world. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And finally, David, in Austin, Texas, a weatherman named Albert Ramon stopped by a fourth grade classroom to talk about his job. You remember when people used to come in and tell you about their job? You've probably gone to a few classrooms and talked
about it. Yeah, I'm always showing up to talk about the wonders of being a radio guy.
Okay. Well, this guy's lecture apparently was so riveting that a student wrote him a thank you note of epic proportions. Here it is. Dear Mr. Ramon, thank you for coming to our school and teaching us about the weather. Someday when I become supreme ultra lord of the universe, you will live in my 200-story castle where unicorn servants will feed you donuts off their horns. He continues, you're more awesome than a monkey wearing a tuxedo made out of bacon riding a cyborg unicorn. And in case you didn't know, that's pretty dang sweet, end quote.
That is pretty dang sweet. That guy's going to have a career in meteorology, possibly creative fiction.
Exactly. Must have been a great lecture. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. And this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.